Good afternoon, and welcome to CSIS. I'm Steve Morrison. I direct the Africa program and the CSIS Task Force on HIV/AIDS, and I welcome you all here today. We're really thrilled and honored that Seth Berkley from IAVI and Zita Rosenberg from the Microbicide Initiative are here to talk to us today. This is part of the broader effort by the task force under its prevention committee, headed by Phil Nyberg and Jen Cates, to broaden the discussion. We've been attempting to pull together Zita and Seth for this discussion today. It fits within an effort that will unfold over the next 10 months to bring together a series of recommendations that will be published in September of next year as part of the advisory on the reauthorization process for PEPFAR. And as Phil will explain, we're trying to use this occasion today and many of the other follow-on events that the Prevention Committee and other committees of the task force will be holding to try and elicit opinion and thinking from key figures like Zita and Seth as they look out into the future on how some of the key policies undertaken by the U.S. and others can be used most effectively to shape what the future may look like. So I thank you very much, and I thank Phil and Jen for putting this all together. I'm going to turn the floor over to Phil.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Actually, I'll just stay here. Anyway, I just want to add my welcome to Steve's, and I appreciate your attendance at this event. Along with Jen Cates, my co-chair on this committee, I was involved in creating the Working Committee on Prevention at the beginning of 2005. One of the handouts describes the function of this committee in terms of its participation and activities and publications. But the gist was that we were concerned that prevention was getting short shrift in terms of attention and resources in the HIV control efforts going on. And not just in PEPFAR, in lots of places, lots of programs. Prevention services were underfunded. Prevention was less exciting than treatment in many ways. There's a misunderstanding or was a misunderstanding of what works and how well it works. And then there was an ideologic gridlock, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with in terms of the politics of different kinds of prevention interventions. The bottom line was or is that no matter how difficult it is, we do need to come to terms with prevention because ultimately, unless there's a slowing of the rate of increase of HIV-infected people, the long-term expansion of global antiretroviral treatment programs is not supportable. And the idea for this working group, working committee, is based really on the CSIS model of bipartisan participation. We wanted to create a forum where people could come together to discuss some of the technically and politically complex issues that are facing us, and talk about differences of opinion in a respectful and less polarized style than is sometimes occurs. And by and large, I think we've been successful on that. Today's session is one of a long sequence of sessions, and they're listed in the description document. I won't go through those, but the planning for this one began, I guess, almost a year ago. But it comes at a time, as Steve pointed out, where attention is now beginning to turn to the reauthorization of PEPFAR, which expires at the end of September 2008. So that in each of the sessions, and including today and forward into the future, we have been and will be continuing to ask the speakers and the discussants to focus on the policy aspects of HIV prevention issues, including adequate preparation for field implementation when interventions become available. finally... Well, I guess that last comment actually transitions into it. One of my personal interests is the issue of translation of scientifically successful research into programs, and it's something that our society or maybe the whole world, is not very good at it, and it, maybe later we'll, there will be a chance to discuss some of the good and bad examples of how that's come about. One of the handouts in particular describes some of the complexities involved with putting microbicides into place in the field once they're available. So today, actually what I'll do now is turn this over to Jen, my co-chair, who will summarize some of the summarize the latest document from the Global HIV Prevention Working Group, which focused on prevention research. And then Jen will introduce the other speakers. Thanks.
Good afternoon. As Phil said, I'm going to talk about another report from another group. It's very confusing, the Working Committee on Prevention of the CSIS Task Force and the Global HIV Right. Prevention Working Group, but they are separate, overlapping to some extent, entities. But part of what I want to do is place today's conversation a little bit in a broader context. As Phil mentioned, we've been trying to have this session for a long time, and due to the high demands on everyone's time, particularly Seth and Zita, it was very hard to find a time to schedule this. And it just so happens that it's coming now after a time when we saw a lot more attention to research in the prevention area, which I think helped to elevate the discussion around prevention. And so this summer at the Toronto conference, the Global HIV Prevention Working Group, which is an international body that's co-convened by the Gates Foundation and the Kaiser Family Foundation, released a report to try to summarize where we are on some of these key prevention intervention research areas. And we're going to talk about two of those key ones today, microbicides and vaccines, but the report also goes into male circumcision, cervical barriers like diaphragms, PrEP, the administration of antiretrovirals before someone becomes infected with HIV, suppressing herpes and seeing what that effect might have, et cetera. And so there are all these interventions that are in various stages of clinical trial research. There's not a lot known out in general other than in the research community where they are, who's doing them, when we might see results. And I think, unfortunately, what I've also noticed is that people think some of these things are already here, and that's a problem. So the report, which we left copies of out there, goes into each of these, what they are, where are trials being conducted, and when can we expect results. But I think more importantly, the report makes a few key points that are really important for today's conversation. One is, even if we are successful in seeing some of these interventions come in, be available in the near term, and by near term we're talking 3 years, 5 years, and longer, we're not prepared as a global community to incorporate them into what we're doing now. And the report goes into a number of recommendations around how to get better prepared and how to anticipate other issues that may come up. For example, the massive need for training of providers. And we already know that that's a need currently, even without any of these interventions. Issues like preventing the fact that there may be a new intervention available on that's a technology might cause people to increase their risk. So how is that going to be addressed? So the report goes into all of these issues. But I think another key point that the report makes, and that we cannot stress enough, is we're not even scaled up with the current prevention interventions we have. So putting aside anything that might come along, we're not even doing what we need to do now with what we know works. And I just want to highlight, sometimes you still hear, we don't know what works. We do know what works. There is actually a good fact sheet that the Global HIV Prevention Working Group put out called Proven HIV Prevention Strategies. It's on our website and the Gates Foundation website. So we're not even scaled up and doing what we need to do with the current proven prevention interventions. We have a lot of barriers to scaling up and getting ready for new ones that are coming down on the horizon. And I think one last thing before I briefly introduce our speakers, even if we were successful tomorrow in seeing a microbicide and in getting results from circumcision trials and finding several of these things where we could say there's efficacy here and there, and even putting all those together with what we have today will not end the epidemic. They will hopefully have impacts, and we think they will. But we also have to understand what's realistic here. And so managing all those expectations while getting ready in an environment where we know there's a resource gap in general is a big challenge. just turning really briefly to putting this now in the context of the CSIS task force, obviously the U.S. government is in an important position to influence and play a key fundamental role in how to both anticipate and respond to any of these interventions, and already is doing so in many ways. For example, the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator has a working group on male circumcision, trying to get ready for what do we do when those results are announced. So there are people at OGAC are already thinking about this. People in the field are thinking about this, but this is just one thing among many. So part of today's discussion, or our main thrust of today's discussion, actually, is to start to lay out what are the things that the U.S. government can be thinking about doing proactively to be prepared and understand how to incorporate some of these things into the package of services already. So I'm now going to briefly introduce our speakers and thank them all in advance for making time to be part of this. First, we're going to hear from Alan Moore, who many of you know, who was the former policy director for Senator Frist for many years and a key architect of PEPFAR, the legislation. And we asked Alan, and actually now he's, I should say, a fellow here at CSIS and the Global Health Council. And we asked Alan to try to help put this in a context to understand what members of Congress might be thinking or not about research interventions and what makes sense from a congressional perspective to even address through legislation or other things that Congress has as its tools to help get prepared. So that's sort of a key question. And then we're going to hear from our two guests, Dr. Zita Rosenberg, who's the CEO of the International Partnership for Microbicides, and then Dr. Seth Berkley, the CEO and president of IAVI. And we have with us then the two leading world experts on microbicides and vaccines. And so we're thrilled that we were able to do this. You can see why we waited till we could have both of them in the same place and try to get to this presentation. And I'll turn it over to Alan. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Jen and Phil. I won't take long because we have experts who've traveled here. You can hear me anytime. It is interesting, and it's a reminder that everybody in this room cares about these issues and knows a lot about the subject matter. Most people in Congress don't know much, don't care much. We're bringing in a retired Senate staffer to talk about the Congress. There's a reason for that. It's hard to get that somebody from that small core of folks on the Hill who care. That doesn't mean there aren't people who care. They care a lot. They know a lot. When we're thinking about an issue like this, there are several audiences in the Congress. We've got the authorizers, the people who work on the committees that authorize, for example, both PEPFAR and will reauthorize PEPFAR, as well as the committees that authorize NIH spending, because remember, we do a lot of research at NIH as well as in PEPFAR, and sorting that out is something that happens in mysterious ways. But those are relatively small audiences, and even within those groups, there are subgroups who care a lot and some who don't particularly. But authorizers think in one way about this. PEPFAR expires in two more years. We're beginning to talk about reauthorization. So there's kind of a long time frame. But what we do when we reauthorize is relevant and impacted by what's going on in the research field. More immediate and more significant year after year are the appropriators, because whatever we do on the authorization side, we both utilize and sometimes ignore on the appropriation side. And year after year after year, it's the appropriators who decide how to divvy up the money that's available. And as an advance is made or advances seem to be coming down the pike, we need to start thinking oftentimes legislatively about how we're going to divvy up the money. Are we going to put more money over here, more money over there? And the appropriators listen to what's going on out in the community. They also listen to what the White House says. The White House is always a major player. The third group in the Congress that is paying attention, maybe paying attention, is Senate and House leadership. If the president really wants something and lets the leadership know, then the leadership can often bring something about. When the president announced that he wanted a $15 billion program over 5 years to fight global AIDS, the Congress acted very fast, and they acted because the president wanted it. The leadership said, get it done. The House committee acted. When the bill came over to the Senate, the White House said, we'd like to have this bill by this summer so the president can take it to the G8 and say, look what we've done in the U.S., what are you guys doing? And that prompted the Senate Majority Leader, Bill Frist, to pass the House bill through the Senate without any amendments. That was controversial. That's created some downstream ramifications. But I remind you that the leadership is its own kind of unique target audience who can make things happen. Now, next week, we may discover that we've got different leadership. We may have different party in one or both houses. I think that's going to be hugely significant in a lot of fields, less so in HIV/AIDS, because I think there's a lot of bipartisan support here. The president still will own PEPFAR, regardless of who's in the Congress, and I think he's been out there leading and will be an important player regardless of what's going on in the Congress. There's another group in the Congress that you can't ignore, and it's sort of the others, because every now and then you'll find a small core of people who are not authorizers or appropriators who can make a difference, one or two or a handful of people. The best example probably is Rick Santorum. Now, although he's a member of leadership in the Senate, when he's acting on behalf of the Global Fund, where he has been remarkably consistent and effective, he's not doing so at the urging of the White House. It's actually contravening what the White House is supporting, and he's not doing it as a member of the leadership. He's using his role as a leader, but he is there's a potential for another audience there. You've got normally two different parties. The Democrats, what might they be looking for? Republicans, what might they be looking for? I think in the case of global AIDS, again, there are differences. We know that there are certain issues that are part of PEPFAR now, the abstinence set aside, the treatment in children set asides, healthcare workers. There are a host of issues out there that have begun to resonate. People will pay attention to those, whether they'll do that, whether they'll try to act on that now or in the context of reauthorization, that remains to be seen. It remains to be seen who's in the leadership. I think that when people think about something like vaccines and microbicides, a variety of questions come into play. And let's face it, to a significant degree, the decisions around those two items are going to be about money. Not just about money, but mostly about money. So people on the Hill who care will be trying to figure out, okay, is there a great need for more money? For what? Make the case. What do we need the money for? What is not getting done? And because it's not getting done, what's the significance in terms of setting back what we think might occur in terms of breakthrough? Now, even as these arguments about money are occurring, people in Congress will say, well, how come the U.S. carries so much of the load? Why is the U.S. carrying 85%+ of the vaccine R&D load? Why is it carrying 3/4 of the microbicide load? So it's not just, gee, is there a strong case for more money, but why us? What's the international community doing to try to bring more money from other governments? And those are some of the kinds of issues that people will ask, because we got scarce resources. Every time we decide to spend more money in one place, we necessarily will spend somewhat less in the other. There's another issue I'll flag, and then I'll let them talk. And that is, right now we've got this curious situation of these set-asides in PEPFAR. At least 20% has to go to prevention, at least 55% has to go to treatment, at least 10% has to go to orphans and vulnerable children. Of that 20% that's available for prevention, at least a third of that has to go for abstinence until marriage. That's been, for practical purposes, redefined as abstinence and fidelity messages. Okay. Those are controversial. Those will be subjects that will be addressed every year, and particularly in PEPFAR reauthorization. It's useful. I mention them here because suppose we have a breakthrough in microbicides and we conclude that we need $200 million, and there's a willingness to spend $200 million for purchase of the commodities, preparation of infrastructure, training, educational materials, and so on to get these microbicides into the field. Right now, we would run into some fundamental conflicts with existing law. To spend $200 million on microbicide distribution, purchase, distribution, etc., current law would require us to spend about $800 million on other stuff because of this treatment limit, orphans and vulnerable children limit, the abstinence until marriage / fidelity requirement. I mention that not because it's going to be some impossible barrier, but because it's just one of those things nobody really thinks about that we will have to address and will have to fix. I don't think that's an impossible task. It's just one of those things that is in the law that we would have to address. So I'll stop there, and then maybe, depending upon how the conversation goes, we can come back to potential policy implications.
Okay. Thanks. Good afternoon, everyone. First of all, I would like to thank CSIS and the Kaiser Family Foundation for organizing this and for inviting us here to talk about microbicides and vaccines and prevention, all within the context of PEPFAR. Good. It is on. So I, as Kate said, as part of the International Partnership for Microbicides, and I don't know how much all of you know about microbicides, although microbicides have now gained a lot of national attention. There are still people who don't really know what they are, and I thought I'm used to kind of having to define microbicides to groups, but I'll go over it very, very quickly. But first of all, just the AIDS epidemic itself, in terms of making the case for microbicides, why they will be needed for the future, we all kind of know, I think, about the increasing feminization of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, and the statistics continue to support the notion that women, unfortunately, are playing a fundamental role in this epidemic in terms of the numbers of people who are infected with HIV. 74% of young people between 15 and 24 living with HIV are women, which means that they are getting infected at very young ages. These infections are also rising in all parts of the world, Eastern Europe, Latin America, and Asia. And in South Africa right now, one in four women are infected by the age of 22. And some of you may be seeing some of the data that is being released now that in the context of HIV prevention trials and screening women for eligibility for these trials, some parts of South Africa outside of Durban are seeing 65% prevalence rates of HIV in women coming to clinics who want to enroll in trials who do not know they're infected. Right, so the numbers are staggering, and those numbers continue. In many parts of the world, these women are married and monogamous. In India, for example, 22% of AIDS cases occur in housewives who've only had a lifetime sexual partner. So I was actually thinking in terms of the 200 million versus 800 million, we can actually say that all of this is going for fidelity messages because it's happening, all right? These women are faithful, and they are getting infected. And many of these women are mothers or will soon be mothers. In Swaziland, more than half of pregnant women ages 25 to 29 are HIV positive. Latest UNAIDS data shows this, the highest prevalence in 5 years. So whereas in some parts of the world these numbers are going down and things are looking very good, in many parts of Africa, especially sub-Saharan Africa, the numbers continue to rise at astronomical proportions. Whoops. Okay, how do we get to the next? There we go. So why we need microbicides is pretty clear. We need something that women can use, women can initiate, since they really are the ones at greatest risk of HIV infection. So microbicides are what we define as any kind of substance that can be delivered vaginally to prevent the transmission of HIV. And the way they look can take many, many different forms. The current products that are all in late-stage trials come in the form of gels that are delivered by a vaginal applicator. There are products that are being developed now that come at the very bottom of the list in intravaginal rings, something that could be used over a long period of time, a month or 3 months or even longer, depending on the active agent in it. And then a range of different kinds of formulations in between. It will not be one kind of product that will be suitable for all women. Women will like different kinds of products and will need them. But what we need, really, is a proof of concept that a drug in a kind of delivery form will prevent HIV transmission. And again, as Jen said, we see this as part of a broader approach to HIV prevention. This is not going to be a single magic bullet in any sense, and none of the prevention modalities will be. And right now, I just have here the existing prevention approaches and where microbicides might fit in, but you can add in here circumcision, diaphragms, acyclovir treatment for prevention of herpes, treatment of index partners for HIV prevention, many, many different kinds of different novel approaches. But within the realm of prevention, microbicides, depending on their formulation and whether they're long-acting or need to be used at the time of exposure, can fill many different niches. So they can be more like a vaccine if they could be in the form of an intravaginal ring that could be used for 6 months or a year, or like pre-exposure prophylaxis or treatment of sexually transmitted infections and the whole range of behavior change modalities. At the time of exposure, clearly male and female condoms are currently used. The prevention for mother-to-child transmission with antiretroviral therapy and post-exposure prophylaxis kind of occurring right after the time of exposure, but nonetheless part of a prevention strategy, especially for healthcare workers. And then, of course, we need treatment and care. And it's not either or. It has to be and. And we constantly get into this dilemma over how we are going to divvy up the resources. It is clear that you need prevention in order to be able to sustainably treat all those who are infected. And you can't treat your way out of an epidemic. There has to be both sides of the equation in operation at the same time. And it just is a matter of resources. That's how we end up getting there. But we see microbicides as a fundamental part of this whole strategy. Now, where microbicides are, there has been a lot of attention. There has been this danger that people already think microbicides exist. They don't yet exist except as an experimental prevention strategy. There are the first generation of products are currently in late-stage trials, the large efficacy trials all over the world that are trying to determine whether or not these products work. There are five such trials. There are four products because there's a few products that are in two trials. And they are being sponsored by non-for-profit NGOs, mostly in the U.S. They are being funded by the U.S. government, by the Gates Foundation, by the Medical Research Council of the U.K., but again, the lion's share being funded by the U.S. government and by the Gates Foundation. And so these trials are ongoing. We should have data on the very first one, the Carigard study. We should have data by mid-next year. That will be the first trial to close and have data, and whether or not it works, we will only know at that point in time. But it is possible by mid 2007, we actually will need to be preparing for scale up for access. And so these questions that are going to affect PEPFAR could occur pretty quickly. Then there's a whole next generation, because we need, and I'll talk a little bit later, about realistic expectations of the first generation of products. We don't know whether or not they're going to work. There are a lot of unknowns in the equation. So the next generation of products must be developed and developed rapidly, because we also know that it is going to be a continuum. The first product is never the best. It will only be built upon. So there is a lot of effort going on, and that's something that my organization is focusing on, the development of new microbicides that are based on antiretroviral agents. Antiretrovirals that were designed and approved and implemented with incredible effects in terms of therapy after the first generation of products were already in the field in early safety studies. So we are now basing a lot of the work, we and others, on antiretrovirals. And these are the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors, the CCR5 blockers, even new products that are just now going for therapeutic indications. So truly the cutting edge of antiretroviral treatment now being adapted for topical use for prevention. And like therapy, the future of microbicides will very likely involve combinations. Because, again, we will see out in the community resistant strains, resistant to one particular mechanism of action. So we may need two mechanisms of action in a microbicide. And it just to increase effectiveness in general, there is always the possibility that that a virus will get past one kind of approach, and having a backup in there is always the right action. And then the novel delivery mechanisms. The existing products that are currently in the large-scale trials, as I said, are gel-based. They also need to be used every time a woman has sex. That limits their usefulness in the sense that if a woman can't plan for that or doesn't know or have control over when she's going to have sex, a coitally-based or a coitally-dependent microbicide will have limited usefulness. So the whole approach, based on the highly active antiretrovirals that have long half-lives, is that you can design a gel that can be delivered once a day and have a 24-hour half-life, so a woman could put it in the morning, normal bathing routine, and that's it. She doesn't have to think about it again, or an intravaginal ring. It's very similar to the whole notion of the birth control approaches that you see on TV now, the once-a-day pill and the long-acting intravaginal ring. It's a very similar approach. What has also happened recently that was not available at the time of the development of the first generation of products is that the pharmaceutical companies are coming to the table, and they are coming to the table with agreements that will allow us to have royalty-free licenses for the developing world. And so IPM has already have such agreements with Tibotec, which is part of Johnson & Johnson, with Merck, with Bristol-Myers Squibb, or negotiations with several others to get access to their highly active antiretrovirals so that we have freedom to operate and set the price and the distribution in developing countries. And so these agreements are actually allowing us to use public money to develop these products. And as I mentioned before, the realistic expectation of microbicides, it's very important that we know that if the first generation does not work, it will be at least 5 years until the next generation is available, because we have to go through the entire clinical trial efficacy process, which cannot be shortchanged. But when we look at what happened with therapy, I mean, it was in 1983 that HIV was identified, and in 87 that AZT was available. And it wasn't until 95 that you had a two-drug combination approved, and then three-drug in 97. So there was a 10-year span. And when we look back and we think monotherapy was really not the way to go, but it was the only way to go, and it kept people alive to avail themselves of the double and triple therapy. And now we're focusing on novel kind of packaging so that people can take them a lot easier. And in 2006, you had 26 approved drugs. Microbicides will follow a path that hopefully it will be more compressed than this, that we will have seen what happened in ARVs and be able to take advantage of the lessons learned. But it still will follow a developmental path. But it's also incredibly urgent, because we keep hearing that, and we know that women are getting infected, they may not be able to avail themselves of treatment, and we may not be able to sustain treatment. And we also know that the access issues, how are we going to get these products available to women in developing countries as soon as possible? Historically, it's always been available in the U.S. or Europe first, and then it takes 10, 15, 20 years or more to get to the developing country, and that can't happen. So the microbicide field as a whole has been committed from the start to expediting the availability, widespread globally, of any effective product, specifically for those countries which are involved in the clinical trials first, but rolling out to as many developing countries with the highest incidence of infection next. And all of us, all the ones, people in this field, are working on the assumption that these products will be available at low or no cost. And again, who's going to pay for it? We need to be able to have the resources available for that. So some of the cost and financial gaps. In 2005, globally, $160 million was spent for microbicide research and development, which is actually not a lot of money when compared to a lot of other areas. A lot of the modeling has shown that the field will probably need at least $300 million in 2006 and in each of the subsequent 5 years to accelerate product development. And where these numbers come from are the costs of the large-scale efficacy trials. Because incidence rates get affected by the conduct of your trial, you know, women are enrolled in a study, they are counseled, they are provided male and female condoms, they are, all of their sexually transmitted infections are treated. Just as a result of being a part of a study, incidence rates generally go down by about a factor of two. Many, many women need to be enrolled in these trials in order to show whether or not a product will reduce the effectiveness of a microbicide of HIV by 50%. So these trials enroll thousands and thousands of women. They require infrastructure, training, development costs. Chris is in the audience. I mean, he's been working on this since the mid-90s. It requires a huge, sustained investment for sites to be able to conduct clinical trials to generate data that will be acceptable to regulatory authorities. What we can't do are conduct these studies and then have audits by the Food and Drug Administration or the European Medicines Evaluation Agency and then come in and say, you didn't do it right, we're not accepting your data. Okay, that would be a waste of taxpayers' dollars and a waste, incredible waste, of all of the devotion and sacrifice that the women have contributed to these studies. So we need to do these studies right, and we need to build the infrastructure. Places like Johns Hopkins or Harvard or Case Western do these clinical trials because they have had 50 or more years of sustained support from the U.S. government to be able to run clinical studies. And that has not existed in developing countries, and we are working against the clock to be able to create an infrastructure, and it requires money. And the trials can cost up to $100 million, each one of them. The current donors, and it is true that the U.S. government is paying the lion's share for microbicides, but the current donors for microbicides include six European governments now, the Canada as well, the World Bank. IPM, when it was created, was able to mobilize a lot of resources from Europe, and that trend will continue, and it needs to continue. It can't just be the U.S. government shouldering the burden. But if we do look at U.S. funding, NIH currently is spending the most amount of money on microbicides, and this is, as NIH's mission is, its basic research. Most of it is going for basic research to develop the knowledge base that will allow us to come up with the better cures and prevention. They also are involved in site development and in clinical trials. The Centers for Disease Control is involved, and USAID as well is funding a lot of this work. So the total in estimated for fiscal year 2007 coming from the federal government is about $123 million. And so of the $160 million that was funded, a huge amount is coming from the U.S. federal government. And the emphasis on microbicides is increasing. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases will be announcing a dedicated program for microbicides very soon. So everyone is kind of thinking about microbicides and acting accordingly. Now, clinical trial locations. One place that PEPFAR can play a role, not just in its reauthorization in terms of access and buying products, but also in how we actually conduct these clinical trials. The first countries where microbicides will be rolled out, should they prove effective, will likely be in the countries that have some experience in testing these products. And so PEPFAR has a number of focus countries, and I've highlighted in white those that correlate with the countries where the current or potential trials are going on. So there is a fair amount of overlap. And one would think that should any of these products become effective, these are the countries where you would want to get them rolled out first. And so the funding for the focus countries and the potential access countries could have significant overlap. So what is needed? Again, you need sustained increased financial support. You can't go in and out, start clinical sites, clinical trials, and then stop them and not continue the infrastructure. The people who are working there will find other jobs. They will leave. You will start from scratch. The infrastructure will fall apart unless there are some other mechanisms involved to keep everyone active there. It will be a wasted resource. You need to have sustained support. And continue PEPFAR and U.S. government focus on treatment, and then greater support for prevention sciences. One thing that wasn't mentioned yet is PEPFAR right now is not funding research. In the prevention area, should it actually be helping to fund research, and how can that be done? And one way would be the support for the clinical trials. Because, again, in the clinical trials, what is happening, and I'll take, again, the example of Durban with the 65% prevalence in one of the areas. Those women who are recruited for the study are infected. They don't know they're infected. They need to be referred for care. So those people who are come into your study and are not enrolled because they don't meet criteria need services. PEPFAR can help there. And then when women in your trial become infected during the course of the study, ethical obligations are such that these women who have sacrificed time and effort and risk their lives for these studies need to be able to have access to care. So PEPFAR can help there for the clinical trial volunteers who seroconvert. And these are liaisons that can happen even within the existing framework were certain changes to be made. So conclusion, microbicides are definitely nearly there, and you don't want to be the one who says nearly for the next 10 years. But given the first generation of products, it is possible that they could be available within several years, given the next generation of products within 5 to 10 years. But that is going to require sufficient resources and leadership, especially on the part of the U.S. government. Thanks very much.
Well, I'd like to start by thanking the Kaiser Foundation and CSIS for inviting me. Of course, after listening to Phil and Jen and Alan and Zita, they've made most of the points I want to make. So what I'm going to try to do is, if I can, take you through some slightly different ways of thinking about some of the points they made, because I do think it's very important to put a lot of this in perspective. And Zita put up a slide thinking about women. When I think about the epidemic, I think about this, and I just want to take you back for a second because I know all of you know HIV, but this is a slide looking at life expectancy for a child born in 2010 with AIDS and without AIDS. And if you look at Botswana all the way to the left, you know, going from the mid-70s down to below 30, I mean, this is an epidemic so profound to societies. This is not in a subset. This is country life expectancy. So we're talking about something really extraordinary here. And you know, just to start with the assumption, and Alan talked a lot about, you know, and Jen did about what works, the fact is that the tools we have today aren't enough, even if they're perfectly used. We'd have to do better. It's absolutely critical. But we know we have 11,000 new infections daily. So if you think about the comprehensive response, it's delivering for today using the tools that that we've got today to try to prevent the further spread and treat those who are infected and to mitigate the societal impacts. But we do need better tools. And you've heard about microbicides. I'll talk about vaccines, but a whole range of other issues as well. So critical to think about it in the comprehensive fashion. And Zita made the point, it isn't either or. It has to be both. And the other thing that I want to mention, and I want to do it from a very hard financial side, is that better prevention in general, but particularly having tools like AIDS vaccines, is critical for the affordability and sustainability of the commitment to universal access. I don't need to do this because Zita already did it. I have my own toolkit to list those. But if you go back and look at some of the modeling that's gone on, You know, an AIDS vaccine offers the best hope of curbing the epidemic. This is looking at vaccines being introduced even with all the other interventions, even with the scale-up for universal access by 2010. And what you can see is that even with a vaccine with very low efficacy and very low coverage, you can prevent a lot of infections. But high-efficacy vaccines, dramatic effect on number of new infections. You know, the question people always ask is an AIDS vaccine possible? Haven't we been trying for 25 years or whatever number you want to use for an AIDS vaccine? Well, I'll tell you later that only one vaccine has been fully tested to see if it works. And so there hasn't been the type of aggressive effort that there needs to be. But what we'd like to do is have an AIDS vaccine that really does the top thing, protects against HIV infection through sterilizing immunity. If we had that, we could do the thing that Jen said perhaps we can't do, which is talk about ending the AIDS epidemic. That's what we'd like. That is obviously going to be the hardest thing to do. But it doesn't mean if you can't do that, that protecting against progression to disease, which is what many vaccines currently do, wouldn't be useful. Or even if you had a vaccine that just reduced transmission, so-called public health vaccine, that would have a dramatic effect on the epidemic. And what we know is that there's a whole set of examples in humans and in animals experimentally that show you can have immunologic control of HIV. There are vaccines that in animal models, and again, the animals aren't models aren't perfect, but in animal models do provide protection. So we've got pretty good examples to show that AIDS vaccines are possible. So what's happening in the field? Well, like Zita said, that people are now paying more attention to microbicides. There's enormous amount of political commitment now for AIDS vaccines compared to what used to be. That being said, the critical issue is going to be sustaining this effort over time. In terms of expenditures, a lot of money is being spent. You can see here a number of $759 million by last calculation. The United States is the vast majority of this, 85% of this. But again, the important point to make is, as Zita did, that a lot of that money is going into basic research, critically. You can never do enough basic research, but one of the issues is making sure that the money is distributed across all of the functions, and I'll come back to that. You can see that the philanthropic sector is a small proportion. Commercial sector is really only about 10% of it, which is problematic, and non-U.S. public sector only a little bit more than that. So we've tried to go ahead and list by countries the different amounts being spent, and of course the argument has to be that other countries need to pull their weight more, as has already been discussed. When we look and try to model, there is no such thing as an adequate amount of money to be spent on anything. The more money you spent, the more likelihood you have to accelerate it. But clearly, at some point, you waste more and more money. And so one of the things we try to do is model what the ideal amount of money to be spent would be, how many things could be moved in parallel, how to drive it. And so our best calculations are that more resources are needed. And the reason is that those really need to be directed at some different things that are not being done now. Obviously, it is possible that some of this could be done through reallocation, but the point is there are still gaps that aren't being filled in the vaccine area, which would be important to try to accelerate the effort. Like Zita's list, there's now a lot more activity. When I started working in this field about a decade ago, there hadn't been trials in the developing world. There was no focus on it, and you can see now there's really quite an active program of vaccine trials that are going on around the world. So the field is moving, but there are some major challenges. The science is growing, but it still remains the major impediment. There's now over 30 candidates in the pipeline, yet only one candidate has been fully tested to see if it works, which I think is shocking given the number of years involved. And currently all the candidates focus on cellular immunity, which may be an important component, and it may actually be the type of vaccine that blocks disease progression, but we need a broader-based pipeline. More countries are involved, and there's now been a big increase from the NIH and the Gates Foundation and this new effort, the Enterprise. However, the response is still inefficient in most countries and from industry. And as I said, developing countries are more engaged, but we need to make sure to sustain that over the long run and help build up their systems. Now, In terms of timeline, I'm not going to talk a lot about science. I just want to put one slide up on it. And this is really, like Zita mentioned in Microbicide, I call this the 2008 to 2010 dilemma. The next candidate, next generation of candidates coming forward will be led by the Merck Corporation candidate. It's a vaccine called an adeno-5. It's a common cold virus that you've taken out the virus pieces and put in some HIV. The results are going to be from an efficacy trial in preliminary in 2008, final in 2010, and there are three possibilities. The first is that the vaccine works, and it works pretty well. And in that case, we would want to make sure to get the vaccine out, and I'll come back to that. But one problem is that this particular vector, adeno-5, if you've been exposed to it in the past in a common cold-like way, you may not respond to the vaccine. And it turns out in the United States about 20% of the population has been exposed to it, but in the developing world about 80%. So there is a movement now, in case it does work and work well in the trial but doesn't work in the developing world, to create candidates that would be applicable for the developing world. That's work that we're doing and others are doing. Second possibility is that it does something, but it isn't great, and that will change the whole field, because once you know, you know, what's required for protection, that will change the entire science. And then it's really a matter of adjusting the different approaches and working on them, trying to enhance them. But there is a possibility that it's not going to do a damn thing. And one of the challenges then is that you've got to have other types of vaccines moving forward in the pipeline. And, of course, the critical issue is going to be, if that happens, is how do we sustain the effort? How do we have people not say, well, gee, we've now tested, you know, two vaccine types over these 20 years. They didn't work, so let's just give up. And again, to remind you, all experimental evidence suggests that a vaccine is possible. So the challenge is, how do you really drive this forward? We've put out in the front AIDS vaccine blueprint. We do it every 2 years. It's kind of a comprehensive document, tell you everything you need to know about vaccines. What's important is that we believe that an AIDS vaccine isn't only about money. It's obviously money's involved, but you need an enabling political environment. You've got the correct policy choices. You have to have leadership. You've got to have the right regulatory things. And it's all built together to try to make a success here. And so in this particular report, as I said, we do every 2 years, we argued that we should not only continue the current collaborative scientific empiricism, that is, take vaccines that look promising and test them in people, but also go back and try to do much more aggressive, rational vaccine design, to try to go, like they do for drug development, to go and begin to try to understand how vaccines work and go ahead and try to use the tools that people use for high-throughput screening to make vaccines. Also, to try to change our models for AIDS vaccine trials, and this is a quite controversial thing, and that is to really go into high-incidence areas quickly and try to get very quick answers on whether it's likely that these are going to work or not, rather than doing these very large licensing trials right up front. And finally, the issue of capacity building you've already heard, and I'll come back to that as an important issue, but establish these networks of excellence to pave the way for lots of future trials that may be needed. And obviously, all of this requires long-term financing, political support, management of expectations, et cetera. So let me just say a word about IAVI before I jump into my last part of the talk about PEPFAR, and that is our mission is to ensure the development of a safe, effective, accessible preventive HIV vaccine throughout the world. Ensure is the critical word. We don't care who succeeds. We work throughout the entire gamut, from soup to nuts on vaccines, from the political side up to access issues. We're 10 years old now, operating in 5 offices around the world and actually active in 25 countries. We're currently running at about $75 million a year with 40-plus R&D partnerships and are currently doing trials in 11 different countries. And what's important about the way we operate is speed, flexibility, and the willingness to assume risk is the model we do. We do this in an industrial-like model with industrial project managers and really trying to drive vaccine development as fast as possible. We don't do basic research. We're about trying to drive vaccines forward almost as if we were a virtual vaccine company. And we combine this with policy and advocacy because we think it all has to be done together, obviously with a commitment to the developing world. And just to give you an example, and Zita mentioned this issue of working on this. this. This is one country. I could just have mentioned many others, but this is in Uganda. This is beforehand. This is now a state-of-the-art vaccine research center that was built partially with U.S. government funds. And what's interesting is that when we started IAVI, people said 10 years ago, you can't do these types of trials in Africa. It's too hard. They don't have the capabilities. Well, this team is not only good clinical practice certified, but they've got validated assays. They're good clinical laboratory practices. Their laboratory is accredited, first laboratory in sub-Saharan Africa to be accredited outside of South Africa, and now they've become a reference center. And the quality of that lab is better than almost any lab in the world. And that's what we've seen over and over again, is this incredible quality you can have in the South. Trials now. Our last set of trials in Zambia, full enrollment in 2 weeks, Rwanda in 6 weeks, countries that had never done trials before, Pune in a week. What we're seeing is shared learning across the countries and incredible transfer of skills. So we're really seeing a global movement, and this is, in a way, what I'm most proud of. Zita mentioned this, but let me give you some numbers on it. This is looking at vaccines in the past. Here's hepatitis B. Totally safe vaccine, relatively inexpensive now, licensed in the 1980s, and you can see where coverage is even now. It's quite low. Same thing with Haemophilus influenza type B. With Gavi, things are perhaps getting better, but the point is that you can't assume that things are going to get out. And so one of the things we have to think about with PEPFAR is how we're going to deal with access. And the one point that people don't think about is that access for an AIDS vaccine won't be the same as access for children's vaccines. This will need to go to adolescents. It needs to go to commercial sex workers. It needs to go to IV drug users. It needs to go to truck drivers. It needs to go to high-risk groups that we don't have mechanisms to reach. And so that's why thinking about this as part of our broader AIDS prevention is critical, because we're going to have to build those systems, or at least piggyback into systems, but most of them you can't piggyback because they don't exist. So the PEPFAR law in 2003 did mention microbicides and vaccines. Actually, I'm not sure that it mentioned microbicides. It mentioned vaccines across the three different diseases as part of the original language associated with it. And, from my perspective, PEPFAR has done a tremendous job in establishing treatment infrastructure in the developing world. Obviously, it varies in different places in terms of what it was built upon, the sustainability nature of it, but this is going to be an important component in facilitating research and clinical trials with eventual access. And Azita's already floated this idea, but I think it is critical that not only PEPFAR, but other programs who are working in these countries should prioritize the provision of treatment and other services to communities where global public good research is conducted. Why is that? In a sense, we all provide treatment, if we have to, for people in clinical trials, particularly people who become infected, because obviously you do everything you can to prevent it. If they become infected, you provide treatment. But that's not the ideal way, because you almost give people an incentive to be in trials, and therefore you take away their free choice. The right way to do it is to have their communities fully being treated and having the facilities available, because then, whether you're in the trial or not doesn't matter. But given the fact that they're giving knowledge to the world, you're paying back their society. That's the right way to do it. And so my belief is that for all of the important prevention research, not just microbicide vaccines, but these other technologies, we ought to highlight this as a priority for these areas and make sure the community is providing care as part of these programs. Other things that could be done, I've mentioned some of the other challenges for expediting vaccine research. Industrial country regulatory agencies such as FDA could help provide training programs, help move the regulatory system forward. But it is also critical that we not harmonize the regulatory system up. And that's an important issue, because one of the things we struggle with is, what's the risk-benefit ratio in different places? Here in the United States, we are way, way on the side of, we can't take any chance of risk. And, there's a huge issue of this. But in countries that have a 20 and 30% infection rate, they may want to move forward candidates that have a slightly higher risk profile. They need to be able to choose that. What we have to do is give them the tools so they can make those decisions on their own. And that means providing capacity and training. This issue of trials of excellence is something that could be built into not only PEPFAR, but the other work that important work that USAID does and Fogarty and others. and that would be to, you know, build places that have a sustained future. It shouldn't be a five-year program or three-year program that's bouncing around. It should be building a center that has the capabilities to do this over a long period of time, something the Army has a long history of doing. Finally, I think encouraging the best young minds to enter AIDS vaccine research, microbe, or other areas through training and providing incentives for them through lots of different programs. This is important because if you look at the generation of scientists, they are, myself included, getting older, and it's important to make sure that we have a next generation that is going to be carrying on this fight. So those are some ideas on how we might think about connecting to the reauthorization of PEPFAR. If I want to summarize, though, I think the important thing is to remember there's a lot of interest and pressure on using these funds to get treatment and prevention out there, and that is a critical component. But if you look at what's going on, by 2010, some people think the world is going to need to spend $40 billion a year to meet all of the needs if we're going to get to the universal access of prevention and treatment and dealing with societal issues. And if you think about that, that number is just going to keep going up because we still have every year more and more new infections over those who are on treatment. So the gap is just getting wider, and we've got to create better tools, and I think that's what Zita and I are talking about. And so my request to all of you is that you keep this in mind no matter which part of the comprehensive agenda you're thinking of. And lastly, I obviously want to thank our donors, particularly USAID, but a whole range of groups that support the important work that we're trying to do. So thank you much, and I will have the audacity to say it, imagine a world without AIDS, because that's where we all want to go, and let's keep that in our goals.
Well, thanks a lot, Duff, to Zita and Seth for laying out these issues. The common theme in the two presentations were the complexity of the issues involved, the need for capacity building in both the research sense and in terms of thinking about field implementation, the amount of money that's needed for future research, the management of expectations, the ethical concerns, particularly informed consent and how those can be appropriately addressed. And the need for preparation in many different ways for field implementation. And so obviously these are not simple issues. I'm going to take the co-moderator's prerogative and ask the first question, and then we'll open this up to the floor. And actually, I guess the first question will go to Seth. And I was wondering how the issue of people becoming HIV positive when once they're given a vaccine is being addressed, and how big an issue that's thought to be now, and how is it being looked at?
Thank you, Phil. The point here is that depending on the type of vaccine, you may, by a common test, be HIV positive. The current generation of vaccines, the cell-mediated vaccines, have less of a problem on that than do the antibody-based vaccines. But what people have done in the past is they've given them a card that states they've been a member of a vaccine trial and that they can call this number to verify that they've been in this trial. I think the more important issue is going to be over time. What we're going to have to do is create assays that will select out for people who are naturally infected versus those who are who are exposed to an immune response from a vaccine that is being used. And those are easy to do in terms of a research assay, but in terms of the practical cheap assays that we need for the field, that is going to be something that's going to be required on the agenda in the future. And that's going to be particularly important because you're going to need to be able to separate those two because for treatment reasons and for public health reasons, et cetera. So that goes on the list of future research needs that are going to be out there, presuming that in the future we'll have successful vaccines.
Could you just clarify for everyone the point that people aren't becoming infected from the vaccine?
Right. Well, it is an important point because traditional vaccines often are live weakened strains of the agents that that cause the disease, and in that case, they are becoming infected with the agent. So this creates confusion. In HIV, the first, you know, it turns out in animal models, if you give weakened HIV, you actually get protection. And so people thought that this is the way one should go. But, of course, there's been two reasons one didn't want to do it. One is obviously a terrible fear that you'd revert to wild type, you know, and if you did that, you'd be giving a fatal disease. But secondarily, some early studies showed that if you gave these weakened HIVs to people, over time it would slowly begin to react with their immune systems and they would begin to get some immune suppression. So that's been taken off the table, and the whole search has been how to create that type of response, which is why we're using these other viruses, but without having any of the safety risks. And so the challenge has been get other viruses, put some little bits of HIV, zero chance of getting the disease because you don't have the full virus, but try to get this type of immune response.
Terrific. It is? Oh, okay. Terrific talks, both of you. I think, you know, the consensus around the idea that it would be enormously helpful for PEPFAR to support treatment just makes sense. Right? That's, in some ways, a kind of a no-brainer. But both of you sort of alluded, and Zita, you alluded to the potential maybe to also engage more in the research effort. And I think particularly as we think about things like circumcision, which may be the first new prevention tool sort of out of the starting gate, that is going to have huge issues around ramp up and surgical theaters in African settings. And it's also going to have, as microbicides may, a behavioral research agenda around condom use, the mix of behaviors, disinhibition potentially. I wonder if you could just reflect on what you think some of the research areas that PEPFAR might consider, or those involved in PEPFAR might consider, that would really help the prevention effort.
Well, I was actually thinking very simplistically and self-servingly about the cost actually of conducting the clinical trials themselves, the building up of the sites, the infrastructure costs, the training, and actually the purchase of the product for the clinical studies, which costs up to $10 million depending on how many people are in your trial, how often they use the product. These are significant costs that go into the research. Health systems research, to my understanding, can actually be done. I mean, in terms of operational research, so your example of circumcision, should the next trial confirm the next several trials confirm the efficacy of circumcision, there's no more research that you need to do in terms of does it work or not. Then it's how should it best work? You know, how do you implement it? And that's really operations research. You know, are there different circumcision techniques that can be better implemented? The training, you know, how can you do this so that infections don't take away all of the gains of preventing HIV? That's operations research. And to my understanding, that actually can be done with existing PEPFAR funds. I may be wrong on that, but so I would like to actually be corrected. But so that, I think, which is why I was thinking much more simplistically, that you actually need to show that these products or these interventions, these techniques work in order to be able to implement them. And what we all need to be doing is shortening that time frame as much as money will allow to shorten it so that you can have these a range of strategies that then get put into the traditional PEPFAR, basket of approaches that they will fund that already exist. But to some degree, if indeed we need to slow down the rate of new infections so that treatment can be more sustainable and that the funds will go further, you need to kind of push up the back end, which is the delivery of new technologies and strategies.
Thank you both for really excellent presentations. I mean, the story that kind of comes across from each of your remarks is that at the same time that PEPFAR is making this massive investment in these focus countries, you've got a massive investment being made in the infrastructure required to carry forward your work in your two respective spheres. And And yet it's not clear, I don't think, to policymakers or to the lay public, how do those investments relate to one another? And as you look forward in the next 5 years of PEPFAR, what advice you would give in trying to tie together, you know, how does the further expansion of treatment, care, and prevention under PEPFAR need to be somehow modified, if at all, in order to promote the field trials, in order to accelerate, shorten, make better, because you're entering the same national environments in many cases and making huge investments. You're building human capacity. You're affecting the environment of health delivery systems. And yet, from a policy standpoint, the story of what that means is not told, nor is there any evident answer right now to, okay, so in the next 5 years, if you were the head of OGAC, how would you behave differently in order to take full advantage of those investments and in order to tie them together so that you're getting a payback in accelerating microbicide and vaccine development? That's, I think, really what I'm taking away, is the fundamental question that we don't have an answer for yet, but 3 years ago, you didn't have those footprints, those large footprints of OGAC and what you have laid down in your respective spheres. And now we're faced with that question. Thank
you. You know, it's an interesting point. When IAVI started a decade ago, we had a fundamental problem, and that is if you went to the average research agency, they said, we don't do research on problems of the developing world. You went to the average development agency, and they said, we don't do research. Now, there are exceptions on both sides. But one of the things we had to do early on was drive to one side or the other. And we chose to drive into the area of development agencies to focus on research because we were interested in trying to work in the countries to make products specific for the countries to build long-term capacity there. Now, one of the challenges is over time to sustain that effort and wrap it around in a way as you're talking about, not just in PAPFAR, but you know, the Global Fund has exactly the same thing. Global Fund doesn't do research, and yet it hasn't necessarily linked its priorities into research. So, you know, for me, there's three things. One is, you know, when you think about the overall global program, you have to make sure that the focus is on research, but research that's appropriate for the developing world. And that's very different from saying to, for example, an academic institution, gee, you should go over and do an experiment in a country. That's not the same as building long-term capacity there. So one is, you know, beginning to have a real dialogue about what's it going to take over the long term to build the capacity to do these things in manpower, in institutions, in, you know, scientific capabilities, et cetera, over a long term, 10, 15-year time horizon for the whole range of public health research. The second we talked about is the most simple, which is providing treatment for the public health good trials and that type of issue. The third, then, is going to be the access, and this is going to be one of the big debates about PEPFAR, and that is sustainability of those efforts. You know, if you went out initially to say, let's get as many people on treatment as possible, that may be very different from let's build systems that are going to sustain out over a long period of time and might be useful to outreach for, you know, microbicides, vaccines, other treatments, circumcision. You know, what are the health systems that are going to be required? How do we supply them? How do we have, you know, the other pieces connected to that? And I think when people go through the reauthorization, they're going to have to think about all those things. And so it's going to be a very different dialogue now. But the danger may be that what people will instead go back to do is say, well, you know, we haven't treated as many people as we want. We haven't gotten out as many prevention tools as we want. So let's just focus on that. And that would be a shame.
It's an issue of maturity as well. I mean, in the beginning when PEPFAR was created, there was a huge need for treatment right off the bat. I mean, and the focus, I think, was appropriate. You have to focus in order to be able to do your job. And I actually think PEPFAR has been incredibly successful. And as we learn more about how treatment is being implemented, how well it is doing, the numbers of new people who are becoming infected, you can see more down the road what things are going to be happening. Just as maturity, you need to start encompassing a broader mandate because it is clear that you're going to need to look at the whole picture. And I think part of, you know, the first part to your answer, if I was head of this office, is you start bringing in the folks who are doing the research and you start talking to them and finding out exactly what's going on. I mean, when we first started approaching folks in PEPFAR in the very beginning, they, appropriately so, needed to focus on treatment and said, well, prevention research is in our mandate. Go, please don't distract us right now. We've got our own job to do. And that was actually appropriate. And I think now it just needs to be broadened a bit. You need to have the conversations. We need to look within each country at what the infrastructures are. The U.S. government needs to look at how its money is being spent overall and where the synergies can occur. And in some ways, in some places, the staffing issues are the greatest, so that you're working with clinicians who are treating, who also want to do research. They're dealing with different mechanisms of accounting, different pots of money. It makes everybody's life easier, and they can do more if there are synergies and people are working together on these issues. And I think that just is an evolution.
Thank you for your presentations. Are there any clinical trials going on in countries where injecting drug use is the primary mode of transmission, as Russia, as the Central Asian republics, with the explosion of poppy growth in Afghanistan? And is there a different mechanism that a vaccine would have for an injecting drug use transfer as opposed to a sexual transfer?
There are trials going on, and traditionally that has been one of the important groups that have been used in the past. I guess the best answer to that is obviously a vaccine needs to protect against all routes of transmission. So, you know, you need to make sure that it would work on all. The intravenous route is going to be the most difficult because you're likely to have a higher volume of inoculum than you would through a mucosal route. And so, in essence, you're challenging the system the most. The other thing that's interesting is that in some of the epidemics, the heterosexual epidemics are quite different in makeup than the IV drug use epidemics. And Chris knows this well, because in Thailand, they were almost completely two separate epidemics, different strains, different, you know, social groups, et cetera. And so if you were thinking about it, if you had to match the vaccines to the virus, and we don't know if that's the case, then you might even have to think about, you know, different strains. So the answer is it's an important thing to think about, and at the end of the day, my guess is it's going to have to be, you know, one that protects against all the different strains that exist.
Just to add one point, and then we're going to your question. Some of the other modalities that are being researched, like PrEP, the pre-exposure prophylaxis of antiretrovirals, there is a trial in Thailand with injection drug users, and the report does go into this. And Chris probably knows several others a few others that may be going on, but there are some other modalities that are being looked at with that population.
Thank you very much for very informative presentations. And I have a couple of questions. And one of them is maybe just a matter of understanding where you're both coming from. I think Dr. Rosenberg said that when we look at the disease, we see that even married, monogamous women are, you know, being, you know, infected. And then Dr. Buckley said that the target groups for the vaccine will be, you know, adolescents, drug users, you know, high-risk groups. And I'm thinking, aren't married, monogamous women not a high-risk group? Secondly, you also said that the vaccine will, you know, in the list of the target group, you also didn't mention children, and yet in Africa, we are seeing children up to 9 years old being infected with the virus because of, you know, violence against girls, you know, in the continent. And I'm thinking we need to have a vaccine also for children, not just to target adolescents. And the last one, which also will go to Alan, is, you know, what opposition are we facing in terms of the moral argument? You know, both microbicides and the vaccine kind of dismisses, or not dismisses, but does not really look at the behavior aspect of HIV prevention. And yet we know that in the current climate in the U.S. and other places, you know, that argument has been very prominent. So how do we reconcile that? And is that a barrier in terms of getting more support for vaccine and microbicides? Thank you.
So if I can start, first of all, thank you for correcting me. I did a little shorthand. You're absolutely right. I mean, from my perspective, if you have a safe and effective vaccine, you want to give it to everybody. But what we know is that you initially, like with any product, will have limitations in the product and the delivery. And so what you're going to try to do is get it to the highest risk groups as quickly as possible. And the highest risk groups, although most of the times the people who get the products, as you know, tend to be the worried well. The affluent worried well tend to get products before anybody else does. But in this particular case, you'll want to go to the highest risk groups quickly, and that's why I listed some of the highest risk groups. And in many countries, adolescents are, and I include going down, you know, to as low as when they're sexually active. In terms of your question about children, not only should they be included on the top end, that is ones that get infected, you know, when they're in their early adolescence, but we also obviously would like to have a vaccine that would protect against mother-to-child transmission. So, you know, eventually what you'd love to have is a vaccine given as part of the childhood immunization series that would protect, you know, for a lifetime, but that's going to be a long time. And one of the reasons to make that point is that, you know, if you think of it that way, even if it worked, you'd have a 10-year lag before you really began to see its effects.
Let me say a word about moral arguments that might surface against microbicides. When PEPFAR was passed, there was discussion of microbicides. It's included in the bill. It's not included in the section you showed on vaccines because it's not a vaccine per se. But there was discussion about it. There was some discussion during debate, or there was a colloquy, actually a written colloquy that was submitted between Senators Corzine and Frist about microbicides and the management of microbicide research. Pauline, I think you are right to suggest the possibility of some concern. I think there's some potentially parallel discussion or concern about microbicides parallel to condoms. That is, gee, if we're going to emphasize microbicides, as the accusation is that in many programs we were emphasizing condoms and ignoring other behavioral changes that were both possible and safer, I could see a conceivable problem. I think, though, that we've learned a lot in the last several years about the discussion of how to put abstinence behaviors, fidelity behaviors, condom behaviors and messages together in a way that makes more sense, works on the ground. Believe me, I'm not saying that the controversy is done. I'm just saying we've learned a lot. And I think that when we do have a usable microbicide, we will have learned even more about how to sort out the right messages for the right target groups. And I think that when there is an efficacious microbicide available, I think that there will be a lot of support in Congress for funding it, so long as it doesn't somehow displace this broad message. And there will be some skepticism as to whether it works. I do recall when PEPFAR was under consideration, there had been a test of what was thought to be a very promising microbicide. I know you'll know the name of what I'm talking about, Zeta, that in fact didn't work. That and there was some evidence that it actually increased the likelihood of infection. And so there are skeptics up there among people who operate, skeptics as to whether it works scientifically. But I don't think that there will be huge resistance to one that works, so long as it's in this inserted into this broader context.
But if I can, it's important the policy wise this because there is also skepticism, or there will be opposition to vaccines, believe it or not. And you may all know that in Illinois there was an attempt to try to take hepatitis B and take it off the mandated list because people who got vaccinated might later on become promiscuous because they were vaccinated, which, I mean, it's hard to believe that somebody would get to sexual active age group and say, gee, I had hepatitis B as a child and I'm going to be promiscuous. But there were people who believed that. And the way this has had an effect is that you know, you might say, well, how come AIDS vaccines aren't seen as profitable? After all, there's a lot of AIDS in the United States still and in Europe, and therefore wouldn't this be a very profitable product? And for vaccines, people, to make the type of money you expect in a short time frame, want the vaccine to be a required vaccine, because then you get large volumes of it out there, and that's really how you make a market in vaccines. Voluntary vaccines tend not to do as well. And most companies are skeptical that given the political environment, it will become a mandated vaccine any time in the early years. And as a result, you know, it may get approved, but it may be one of those that take many, many years of uptake and therefore won't be a profitable product in the most important markets, which has meant that people in the end say, all right, this is, you know, something we're not going to invest in.
I actually have a couple of questions, and then we'll go right to yours. One is for Alan. It's a little bit what we're talking about, but it's both sides of it, in the sense, to what extent do you think members of Congress need to hear information or be presented with a different kind of information about the importance of combo prevention, that we really need lots of different prevention modalities and tools, current, future, et cetera, and if there's a successful candidate or successful microbicide or vaccine at some point, how will that shift? I mean, is there a risk, for example, to lose attention to what we have if attention focuses on something else? And that's one question. And then the second question is for both of you on advanced market commitment concepts, and how is that playing out? And I know the U.S. has been very involved in that as well.
Just a word on the Congress. It two things. One, it comes back to this question of there being not that many people who are interested. And the people who are interested, I think, can manage the broader message. It's just that you have to understand that there won't be that many people listening. Now, there also is a notion in government that sort of just-in-time information, when it's not timely, almost no one will listen, and the people who do probably don't have much influence. Once we know that we're in a serious PEPFAR reauthorization mode or in an appropriations mode where we're looking for new money, then you know who the targets are, and you hopefully have a good relationship with them so they will listen. But if you tell them now something that's not relevant until September, they don't want to hear it, and B, they will forget it.
Start with advanced market commitments first. Microbicides, unlike vaccines, are actually quite easy to make. Most of the work and the drugs that are being selected to work on are actually pretty easy to produce. They're being designed and selected based on cost and ease of manufacture and ability to transfer technology. The gels are very easy to make. We fully anticipate that either gel or ring production could be transferred, the technology, to developing countries actually quite easily. In fact, there's some market surveys that are being done right now about manufacturing capacity in many parts of the world. You don't need a huge lead-in time to develop these and to manufacture them. Advanced market commitments were really kind of a strategy and an important strategy to try to get the private sector involved, pharmaceutical companies. My sense is that for microbicides, at least, the pharmaceutical companies are really not going to want to be involved at all for quite a while. They've been very gracious and willing partners in giving us licenses, but they do not want to do the development nor take the liability on. They really don't perceive that there would be a big market. That might be mine. In the U.S. or Europe. So from our perspective, although it would be very important for us to know that there will be money out there to help whatever organization is manufacturing these products, and there will have to be some kind of profit margin for local manufacturers, not very much. You can actually make a significant amount of money on millions and millions of doses at very low margin. There still will need to be some money out there to guarantee the purchase, because most of the people who these products will be rolling out to will not be able to afford it, and there will probably not be a paying public elsewhere to offset some of those costs. So there will have to be a pot of funds, whether it's called an advanced market commitment or whether it's just PEPFAR or Global Fund or others kind of saying we will have these resources available when you need them. But I'm not sure that this for microbicides is as relevant.
Let me just take a step back and then come back to AMCs. And it's just to make an important point, and that is that the money issue, once you have a successful product, I think is going to be very different. And there may be some displacement, but I think that some of that may be justified based upon, obviously, the efficacy of the intervention. The reason I say that is that we are, and you know, I mentioned this, getting into this, you know, these promises. Every time we put somebody on treatment, they're there for the rest of their lives. And the cost of that and what we're not building in right now, and people aren't talking about it, is you will eventually become resistant to the drugs you're on. So you'll need second-line treatment. You'll need third-line treatment, you know, and you're going to need each time you have more intensive care, there's more side effects, you know, we're going to need new drugs. And I don't know what system is going to be driving those given where the markets are. So this cost structure is going to keep going up until something happens. And I hope what's going to happen is we create better tools and therefore we can slow down the infections. If that doesn't happen, I worry about, you know, the political will of the whole thing when people say, my God, we're spending so much money on this and, you know, what's going to happen. So that's just an aside. AMCs, for those who don't understand what the concept is, if I can just briefly say it, the idea was to create an advanced market commitment. And the way to do that was to say, we will go and subsidize a certain price towards a product if a country wants to buy that. And so we'll, in essence, make an artificial market. So let's just say I'll use a vaccine. Vaccine, we'll call it a dollar to make it, you know, cheap to make it. We'll actually subsidize it up to $15 a dose. Public sector will subsidize it up to $15 a dose. And when the developing country buys it from a company, they will get the $15 a dose purchase. And so what you're doing, in essence, is mimicking what happens in the West, where you charge a lot more for a product than it actually costs to make it to recoup your profits, you know, in terms of doing research. And the concept behind this was, could you create an incentive for industry to pay attention to markets in the developing world where you wouldn't be able to have those natural markups? And it's a quite smart approach, because if you do it that way, then, you know, if midway through you start buying products and a better product comes out, then the developing country says, well, I want to buy that better product now. They then get the incentive for that better product. So it really is a market mechanism. Companies like it. It went to the G8. There was a lot of interest in it. The problem was, where do we try it and what type of product do we try it on? And at the end, there was a lot of talk of, instead of doing a long-term research program, they wanted to do it with products that were very close to being able to get out there. And there's a lot of arguments going back and forth about that. And the reason is that, in essence, that lowers the risk, because you know what the characteristics of the product are. You get an idea of what the manufacturing is, what it's going to cost. However, it's a little bit more like a purchase fund than it is really about encouraging this artificial market. And so there's now a debate going on whether it should be a longer-term product, you know, to test the mechanism, or should it just be one of these short-term products. The advantage for the governments is that once you sign this legal commitment to pay this amount, you don't have to put the money up front until the product appears. And so if you're able to carry it that way, then it's very attractive for a politician, because you can commit to it now and not have to worry about it until it comes out there. From our perspective, it doesn't substitute for push mechanisms, because biotech companies, small players, won't be able to do things. But for the big companies, if you could put a pot of gold out there and say there's not only, you know, profit to be made quickly like you would expect for products you'd normally invest in, but also there's real money to buy it, so you're not going to get caught in the controversies of supplying it to the poor, this would be another incentive. And so we're very supportive of it. And if you're interested in reading more details, there's lots of details on our website.
I'm a scientist who's been working in the AIDS arena for over 20 years. I was at the NIH for a while, and I would like to express my appreciation for the privilege of listening to these very thoughtful presentations. I was particularly cheered by the microside, by the new developments and the strategy. I have a somewhat technical comment, and then followed by a question that really gets to the some important policy decisions on going after the vaccine. It's well known that virtually all successful vaccines have a neutralizing antibody in order to be successful. And Dr. Berkley, he didn't talk about it, but he showed a discussion group. And people know who've been attending the NIH Vaccine Research Center's series and following the work over the years that there is none. And that's why, you know, there's no broadly cross-neutralizing antibody, because to find it, you have to find the part of the virus that actually inserts into the receptor. So the 10 products that are in various stages of about to be tested, I believe none of them elicit neutralizing antibodies. So what's happened, because that hasn't worked out, people are talking about cellular immunity, which is another measurement. And I'm just wondering, as I sat here listening to Dr. Rosenberg's talk, is this the best way to do it? I mean, I thought before, I understand the difficulties to set up the vaccines, but the idea of going through the motions with vaccines testing that people know that all the scientists in the intramural program of the NIH, and people know they have absolutely no hope of doing anything. And if it's about learning something, you know, you can take 10 people in Baltimore. You can take 10 normal volunteers who had come to Bethesda or New York and give them a potential vaccine product. And in 8 weeks, you can see if they made neutralizing antibodies. So why are we going through the motions? And is this the best way? I mean, I know there's a trial set to go for a product that's going to go into 8,000 people in a complex double-blind placebo-controlled. I was listening to, you know, when there's really a hopeful product, then the money will flow. Is this the best way to go about things?
Well, first of all, I have to disagree with some of the premises you make. There certainly have been controversies about some of the vaccine trials, and in particular in products that have been shown to not work in a clinical setting. But the current generation of cellular immunity, we actually show people who are highly exposed and uninfected often have cellular immunity, number one. Number two is, if you use those in monkey models, you can show a reduction in viral load, which correlates with long-term disease amelioration. So the best evidence suggests that, in fact, cellular immunity will have an effect in terms of a vaccine. Now, it is not likely to be sterilizing immunity, but again, people who are highly exposed and are uninfected have evidence of having cellular immunity. So why is that? Is there something we don't know? And so until we test that in people, and that, by the way, is how the whole hypothesis of cellular immunity came up, was a set of commercial sex workers in Gambia, in East Africa, were shown to have this ability to not get infected. And so what people are trying to do is imitate that. So the idea that this is known by scientists to not work, I think, is completely incorrect. The second thing is that in terms of neutralizing antibodies, there now are a range of neutralizing antibodies. There's now 5 of them. Our group has crystallized all 5, shown how they connect to the receptors. Some of them, one particular one, 4E10, neutralizes all the strains of HIV. It's not an incredibly potent antibody, but it neutralizes all strains. So the question, though, is what type of antigen would give these antibodies? And that's the experimental work that is underway to try to answer that. And frankly, that has been an area that has been ignored. There's not a lot of money or attention going to it. So despite the large amount of money I showed you that was going to vaccines, our program at one point was, you know, one of the largest at $5 million a year. So the answer is, we believe the neutralizing antibody problem can be solved, but what it's going to require is a very different way of working. And what we're trying to do is take the high throughput screening mechanisms that are used on the small molecule drug side and take those and put them into working on neutralizing antibodies. Unfortunately, nobody's ever done this before, so how quickly that will work is not really clear.
As we move into the age of genomic medicine and the recent evidence that we've had with the role of human genes, immunogenetics, in susceptibility to HIV progression, and perhaps even to treatment strategies and vaccine strategies. I just wanted to get the thoughts of both of you on, would it be prudent to include some, you know, tests such as genotyping in some of these clinical trials down the road? I'm talking about the future, so that we get better information from what we're doing in terms of treatments and vaccines. Just want to know your thoughts.
I can tell you that these, especially the efficacy trials, where that's where we're getting the most numbers in terms of the populations at risk where we want these products to work, are currently so costly and complex that the approach in general is to keep them as simple as possible. Show that these products work, and then you can have lots of different kind of post-phase 3 studies or post-marketing studies where you get a sense of, are there particular genotypes that will work better in? Is there some kind of immune control vaginally that will restrict virus access, and that the microbicide is just helping certain women and not all women? And there are a lot of questions about innate control of viral replication and transmission, because indeed we're very fortunate in some ways that HIV is such a difficult virus to transmit, which is why it makes, I think, vaccines and microbicides really doable. And I think that we don't have to set the bar to 100%, at least for microbicides, in terms of viral entry, and that you can probably show protection without having to get rid of all viral particles. But whether what parts of the genotype will allow us, the genome will allow us to understand that, and whether the genetics of populations shows that has an influence, is going to have to be a later stage for these trials. We just really need to keep the focus on showing they work first.
You'll be happy to know that the NIH has funded the Center for HIV/AIDS Vaccine Immunology, CHAVI, to a tune of $350 million to take a look at those exact questions. And what it's looking at is trying to get very early infections, look at which viruses are infecting people early, how those viruses change over time, and what type of immune response people's have that affect that, and then obviously the genomics of the people. So they're looking at that whole nexus in a, you know, really incredibly very well-funded, very large program. So there will be lots of answers that will have relevance across the prevention research area.
Okay, we've got time for one more question before we go close. Back.
Because it was linked to something earlier, but I'm curious to know whether, as all of you said, and they were both great presentations, that prevention methods exist, and those have largely been around knowledge transfer and getting people to change their behavior and at the best use condoms to prevent themselves from getting an infection. But I'm just wondering whether the development of technologies guarantees the actual use of them when you get down to the actual level of the individual. And clearly, when we talk about how we're going to divide the investments in making HIV/AIDS methods work, clearly we need money for research to develop the tools. We also need money to develop health systems, because there's a huge health systems failure that has not only prevented HIV/AIDS prevention, but also other health issues. So how, as a global community, are we addressing those problems of health systems, as well as really creating a demand and market that comes from people? Because that's where it's eventually going to go.
Well, especially for microbicides, that is a critical question. And there is no sense in designing products that nobody will use. And one could argue that they might not even use them in the context of a phase 3 trial, so you'll never even be able to show that they work to begin with. That was the whole notion behind moving away, at least for the next generation of products, from something that was coitally dependent. Because we now know enough about women's sexual practices and their inability to negotiate the use of condoms many times, so then why would a microbicide be any different if you have to negotiate it? There is a fair amount now of what we're trying to do of just plain old simple market research. What kinds of products do women want? What kinds of products can women use? thinking about it less from a medical model and more from a consumer products model. Looking at Procter and Gamble and Unilever, how do they figure out the demand for certain consumer products? How would you do that within the context of developing countries? And we've already done a 550-woman, three-country market research survey of three different kinds of gels that don't have any drug in them, just with different properties, to see what people like, what the women like, what their sexual partners like, and have focus group discussions and just do very straight, how would you incorporate this into your daily routine if you were a woman wanted to use the product. If you ask the hypothetical questions, everyone says that they will need a product for HIV prevention, and you tell us that it will work and we will use it. And then you know already in some of the clinical trials that compliance with product use is not great. And we know compliance with product use in general out there in the world for treatment or even prevention is not great. So how can we optimize that right off the bat? And that was the notion of moving towards the intravaginal rings. What can we do? And learning from existing marketed products, mainly birth control, because if we think about some similarities, sex, pregnancy, HIV infection. So we're incorporating that at every step of the way now, because and admitting that the entire microbicide field for the last 15 years, that was really, it was asked hypothetically, but then no one ever took it the next step because so much effort and energy had to go into kind of just designing the products. And so we're kind of retrofitting a lot of it, but it's really being considered very carefully.
I'd like to ask each of our three panelists if they have any concluding remarks.
This isn't so much a conclusion, but just an addition, if you will. It struck me as I was thinking about all this that if Seth or Zita were part of an effort to go to the Hill and say, give us more money for research or for studies in the field, it's one thing to persuade the folks in Congress, but one of the key things that people in Congress look to is, okay, we hear you. You make sense. We trust you. But we, in this world of trust but verify, what typically happens then, and this is true for members of either party, and regardless of who's in control of the executive branch, they then go to the executive branch. They go to NIH to say, okay, we're hearing a need for more research in vaccines or microbicides. What do you guys say about that? And if it's field work or wanting more money from PEPFAR for some of these activities, they go to PEPFAR, they go to OGAC and say, here's what we're hearing, what's your response? And so it's important, I think, and this is all my only point, that it's not just a need to go and persuade Congress, but to persuade the people that Congress will look to for advice and counsel, because the White House, the administration, the executive branch has a voice ultimately in all of these things. So it's not enough just to persuade the Congress, usually. You better persuade everybody in that circle.
If I can just take up an interesting point on that, and that is one of the hardest experiences in trying to build a global movement around this is separating the national from the global. So in every country we get financing from, there is a subset of scientists in the country who said, well, you know, that IAVI stuff's okay, but, you know, we need more money for our scientists, my lab, my facility, my whatever. And, you know, our job is to try to convince the politicians that, one, that's true, because you're going to have breakthroughs from basic science, from what, you know, scientists do in their own work. But then you have to have a way to take the best products and drive those forward. And that's really the role we play. And so, again, it isn't an either and or, but it becomes a very hard issue because there's always this, you know, do more for us. And so it's almost impossible to get, you know, the scientists to say what you, I mean, in many cases to do that. And so what you have to do instead is try to explain what the roles are of the different groups in trying to accelerate these activities. So it's an interesting problem.
I was going to pick up on the same thing. It was what Seth had said right off the bat. There is a difference between basic research and drug development. And in pharmaceutical companies, the R&D, the research and development, there is tension there as well, even within drug companies. There are budgets for the research, and then you need to decide what you've researched, what looks like your lead candidate, and you drive it forward. And the development side of it is actually not sexy, not really fun. It's grunt work. It is manufacturing. It is stability assays. It's lots of freezers and lots of pieces of paper that you are just constantly recording things to make everything according to good manufacturing practices and good laboratory practices. And that isn't what scientists and that isn't what NIH does, and nor was it ever designed to do. It was designed to push forward basic research and clinical research, but not literally product development. That is has always been the domain of the pharmaceutical companies or the biotech industry. But for global public goods, it is now these product development partnerships, which is taking on that mantle. You know, we have a formulation facility, we have a manufacturing facility that is part of what we do, and all we do are have people kind of keeping all the logs of every batch that we make on everything. That is not fun science. And so there is this distinction which I think Congress needs to understand and the administration needs to understand, that it's not that we want research dollars, it's that we need product development dollars. And there really isn't a home for that within the U.S. government in general. That's always been the private sector's home.
I'm just going to make one observation, which is really to underscore a point that Steve made, because I was thinking as well, and I think it's looking forward to this next phase of PEPFAR becomes so much more important, which is how do we better capture the potential and maybe even existing synergies that could or are taking place in the field as your entities and other related efforts are building up infrastructure around research and development efforts. PEPFAR and other donors are building up research, building up infrastructure around delivering treatment and prevention. I'm sure there's already overlap going on, and there's probably good stories to tell there, as well as lessons to be learned moving forward and really capturing that and building on it, I would say. So I'm just going to take a moment to thank everyone for coming and thank our speakers for being here for some great presentations and really helping to put this in the context of thinking about PEPFAR and the role of the U.S. government in the global context. I didn't know if you had anything to add, but I'll just thank everyone from the Kaiser Family Foundation's perspective.
Well, just let me add my thanks from the CSIS perspective. For those of you who did not get a direct notice about this meeting, Elizabeth Hoffler, or Elizabeth Sullivan and Kate Hoffler are in the back, and you can provide an email address and so to get on the mailing list. And again, just let me add Jen's thanks. I'd like to thank our panelists for the presentation today.